Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to an encore edition of Soundcheck.
If you don't know by now, Doggy Dog is a freak.
The job description for rock journalists can include emotional interviews with Johnny Cash, an ill-fated run-in with Courtney Love, and apparently going shopping for Pampers with Snoop Dogg. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, a music writer reveals what you didn't read in the interviews. And later, the Southern-bred, Brooklyn-based songwriter Matthew Houck records under the name Phosphorescent. He'll play live in the studio. But first, in a career that spans two decades, rock journalist Neil Strauss has written for the New York Times and Rolling Stone. He's written best-selling books, including a tell-all tome with heavy metal band Motley Crue. Now, Neil Strauss has written another tell-all with himself at the center. It's called Everyone Loves You When You're Dead, Journeys into Fame and Madness, and it collects unpublished bits and anecdotes from more than 200 interviews he's conducted with everyone from David Bowie and Lady Gaga to Kenny G. He joins me in the studio to talk about it. Neil, welcome to Soundcheck.
All right, thanks for having me on, John.
So, first things first, how do you end up shopping for Pampers with Snoop Dogg?
That's the great thing about doing your interviews outside of the studio, because you never know what's going to happen with rock stars and
Can
rappers
I tell
in the
you,
wild.
I never know what's going to happen inside
exactly,
the studio.
Exactly. And it was such a weird time because Tupac and Biggie had just gotten shot. He was off Death Row Records. He was just basically on his own living out in the hills outside Los Angeles. So I went over to his house and just so weird stuff happens, especially when they're not promoting an album but in the middle of the creative cycle and don't know what they're doing. So he locks me in the studio and starts playing all these songs about how – and there are these angry Snoop Dogg songs, not that guy you just heard, but mm-hmm. but talking about how Suge Knight was responsible for Tupac's death and how Suge Knight's wife ripped him off for money, these angry songs. After he's playing these tracks, he opens the door to the studio – above which a sign says, by the way, home, honey, I'm high. Very Snoop Dogg. And he says, did you tape any of those tracks? I'm like, no, man, of course I wouldn't bootleg your stuff. He's like, no, I want you to tape them. He's like, please. He's like, I have nobody. I'm alone. Like, leak them out to radio. Get them on the internet. Do something with them. And so he made me tape the songs. Then he's like, listen, do you have a car? Because I don't know where my car is, and we got to go get Pampers. So
he didn't know where his car. He's at home, but he didn't know where his car
his
was.
His wife might have been out with him, okay. Or his fiancée.
So
he didn't misplace it in the parking lot.
Yeah, right. Did you in fact leak his songs?
I just moved to Los Angeles, and I was worried just because driving with a gangster rapper and you're at that time in Los Angeles is like a death wish.
Yeah.
So and then I just got worried because it really was like a time when everyone was getting shot and killed, and I didn't want to get in the middle of it. So I still have them, and I recently listened to them, and they're really good, and they've still never been online or anywhere.
Wow.
I should have brought them today. We could have leaked them.
Absolutely. So the book is called Everybody Loves You When You're Dead. I want to ask you about the subtitle,
right.
Journeys into Fame and Madness. Why, in your experience, and you've done thousands of these interviews, why do fame and madness so often go hand in hand?
Yeah, you know, I think, and it's funny, and sometimes madness and the desire for fame without fame go hand in hand too, and I'm just as interested in those people who are in there too. But
there's one interview snippet with racists, just random racists.
I'll tell you that story later. It's an insane story. But I think it's that desire to be known, that desire to be famous, that desire to be recognized. I think a lot of that comes from traumatic experiences when you're younger and feeling unloved as a child, and especially if you were, you know, abused and traumatized in some way, and it felt like you grew up without love, and now you somehow seek it from the world, and then it gets misdirected, and also it's like a drug addiction, because you can't keep it, and you just need another hit and another hit, and when you're not getting it anymore, they do wild, crazy, mad things, and eventually, there's a great line Bruce Springsteen said in the interview. He says, for anyone to handle the leap of consciousness it takes from playing in your garage to playing for 50,000 people, it's the human being, the mind is not meant to handle that.
Wow. And these are themes that recur throughout the book. Drugs, addiction, trauma, you know, working through things that happen to people, you know.
Yeah.
One of the sort of selling points of the book is that, you know, they talk about Neil Strauss made Lady Gaga cry. You made her cry by mentioning, you know, a love affair that had gone sour.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Even just years ago.
So on the other hand, there are moments of real kind of genuine passion and emotion and where you get a real glimpse into the people behind these celebrities. One example, and it comes early in the book, is Johnny Cash, who, you know, has a near-death experience. Well, will you tell the story?
Yeah, it's funny. I was just talking to Phosphorescent, your next guest, about that. And the whole point of the book is waiting for those moments when someone just opens up to you and you just see who they really are. And the great thing about these interviews for Rolling Stone is maybe you're with them for days or weeks or sometimes months in multiple cities, and you can just take your time and see that crack there or that humanity there. And within the case of Johnny Cash, he was talking about how it was just chilling. He was talking about how he went to he was sick. He was in the hospital. The doctors thought they were losing him. And he started to go. And he started seeing this white light. And he said it was beautiful. It was indescribable. It was amazing. And then all of a sudden he woke up. And he was just in pain. And he goes, and I was just disappointed. Mm. And I go, what do you mean disappointed? He goes, you know, whatever that was I wanted to be there. It was a beautiful thing.
Now, how much time had you spent with Johnny Cash when he said that?
We'd spent about two or three days together at that point. Uh-huh. And it was just and looking back on these interviews in retrospect, it makes it easier, the passing of someone who's a legend and who's close to a lot of people. And I'll give you an example of the opposite, which is Rick James. Mm-hmm. When I interviewed him, he said, you know, his goal for the year is to leave that bleep bleep cocaine alone. So, and what happens is a few years later he dies and there's cocaine in his system, and mm-hmm. you feel bad for those people who never got to resolve those issues.
Well, they're both telling moments, and they are recounted in Neil Strauss's new book. The book is called Everyone Loves You When You're Dead, Journeys into Fame and Madness. Here is Johnny Cash.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine, I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you, because you're mine, I walk the line.
Johnny Cash, quoted in Neil Strauss's new memoir, is saying he saw the light when he nearly died on the operating table back in 1988. It's just a moment from a much longer interview, almost, Neil, is the wrong word for what you do.
Yeah, they're like mini adventures.
Yeah. I mean, you basically live with someone for a day or two. Or what's the longest you've spent with someone?
The longest was a year.
Really?
Yeah, it turned into a book, but just about that 1 year. And it was with, I'm fascinated by the dark side. And so it was Dave Navarro, who's in Jane's Addiction and was in the Red Hot Chili Peppers for a little. And he was in a bad point of just shooting up cocaine every 15 minutes, shooting up heroin, ordering. I realize we're getting racy. Is this okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
ordering, you know,
$2,000. Rock and roll.
Ordering $2,000 prostitutes. It was just so dark, and I was there sort of documenting it and saving the life when I could.
That's what I wanted to ask. Yeah. Is like, how do you simply observe that sort of thing? I mean, when do you stop being the journalist and start being, hey, I've spent 9 months with this guy, I got to do something here.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, and I had tried at different points the thing with an addict is they'll listen to you saying that they need to go get help, and they'll play along and they'll humor you just to make you feel better about having done something, but they're not going to do something until they hit their bottom and they make that decision. That's what interventions are. They kind of force that.
Right.
But I said the coke's like, it's like gasoline. You need it to keep your car going. And goes, well, the only difference is that gasoline doesn't eventually deteriorate your car. So he's sitting there just destroying himself and knowing it's okay. And there's a narcissism. Like, he would call me overdosing and say, come over quick, bring your tape recorder and bring a camera, I'm overdosing.
Wow.
And I'd be like, you know what, if you're, Yeah. So there's a crazy narcissism to the self-destructiveness.
Was this for Rolling Stone that you were doing this piece?
I think it might have been for Spin magazine, and then it kind of turned into a book.
Yeah.
I suppose I'm talking now. I sound like I was an enabler by even documenting it and making it seem cool. But the good news is, in the end, he did get clean.
You know, it does seem, Neil. And I said, you know, what you do is almost not an interview. This is an interview. You know,
right.
Someone comes in, we sit, we talk for 20 minutes. Maybe something happens. Maybe we get something that hasn't been said somewhere.
Right.
But what you do to really spend time outside in people's lives and just kind of be able to talk to them
right. Without
the Q&A format,
right. That
seems to be what the germ of this book is.
It's those
little moments.
Yeah, and you're embedding. Even with Kenny G, like, he was a pilot and we flew around New York and went to Long Island. So you're really embedding in their lives and sort of waiting you're waiting for the part that's not an interview.
Yeah. And it sounds great, except for when it doesn't sound great.
There have been some horrible experiences.
And Courtney Love did not sound like a great experience for you. What happened there?
I would say the moment when I realized I was sort of in trouble is it began as an hour-long interview in our record label offices and somehow turned into like a three-day kidnapping in her loft downtown. And I guess she really wanted to do some acupuncture, and she started just sticking me in crazy places with these acupuncture needles.
I want to do acupuncture. This guy's interviewing me. Let me put two and two together and get 22.
I know. I got to say, rock musicians are so much more fun than actors to interview because they can get away with anything. And then I just know the moment when I was in danger was when she was picking up the used acupuncture needles off the floor, and who knows whose body they had been in, and trying to stick me with them. That was when I had to draw the line.
All right. So there are a couple of moments from your interview with Courtney Love in the book called Everyone Loves You When You're Dead.
I'm all I want to be. A walking study. Look at my face. My name is Might Have Been. My name is never was. My name's forgotten.
Courtney Love and the band Hole, and the song Celebrity Skin, Celebrity and what's Behind the Mask. That is at the heart of Neil Strauss's new book, Everyone Loves You When You're Dead, Journeys into Fame and Madness. They're not full interviews. They are the outtakes, I guess, Neil. They're the things that were on the editing room floor that were just too good to be lost forever.
Some were outtakes and some were just the best moments. Like, there was a 5,000-word article, but just this one moment was, forget the rest of the article, and this was the moment where something happened. So you were saying off air that you just got an email from someone who said, what would the John Schaefer tell-all be? And it made me think that, let's just say I was doing your profile, embedding myself in your life. Where would that moment be? Where would we go, or what would we do?
I think it might actually come back to Courtney Love.
No, but for real, what would be the moment? Where would be the moment where we'd see you in your element, outside of this building?
Playing third base for the softball team, perhaps. I really don't know.
Yeah.
You would not want to be embedded in my life. You'd be in this room an awful lot.
But you know, I'm going to tell you something. The people who say that are the most interesting people. If you take Charlie Sheen, he's showing you everything, right?
That's right.
You see the dark side. It's all out there on the public and the surface. And when someone says exactly what you said, that makes me more interested.
So when someone is a larger-than-life personality and you go in there and you think, wow, this is going to be amazing, has it ever turned out that there's just nothing behind the facade?
No, I've never found that there was nothing behind the facade, but sometimes I found that people were different than expectations, that maybe you prejudge someone because of their media image, and you find out that they're a little more – a good example is Chuck Berry.
Or Stephen Colbert.
Or Stephen Colbert. That's a great example. Stephen Colbert, who I really expected to be this sort of flip, ironic, liberal pundit guy, was a very semi-apolitical, very Christian, teaches catechism to – to children, mm-hmm. And it's in Sunday school, and it was almost like closer to Ned Flanders than who he is on the air. And that's what I love about that job, is you get to meet these people and find out the humanity.
And it comes in very tiny bits, you know. Right. I mean, there were no chapters per se there were thematic centers and stuff. But really, the longest of these excerpts is maybe a couple of pages.
Right. And I designed it. There's a book by John Berger called Ways of Seeing. Do you know that book? It's a great art book. And he has chapters that are like just kind of paintings. And as you turn through them, ideas kind of pop in your head. And it's about the juxtaposition. And I made this. There are plenty of music history books. Nowadays, if you want facts, you can get on they're not facts, but you can get on Wikipedia and find the general idea. So I wanted these kind of juxtapositions of ideas. So it's for... I'll give you a quick example, mm-hmm. which is you have a short Christina Aguilera clip where she was 19. It was her first time talking about being a victim of domestic violence growing up. The next interview is a small clip with Ike Turner talking about Tina, so you see it from maybe the victim and then the perpetrator. The next one's a guy from At the Drive-In talking about being an incest survivor. And so maybe through these things you just see through the prism of different types of abuse. And other sections are on UFOs or psychic experiences, and different things sort of show you that prism through these points of view. So it's not so much about the person, but, you know, the lesson we learn from their experiences.
Mm-hmm. The book, again, is called Everyone Loves You When You're Dead, Journeys into Fame and Madness, from Neil Strauss, who's written for Rolling Stone and The Times and several books as well, and who's my guest on Soundcheck today. I mentioned tonight you'll be with Sammy Hagar at the Borders Books at Columbus Circle at 7 o'clock, and then tomorrow you're in Brooklyn at the Book Court
at
7 o'clock. That's just you.
Yeah.
All right, we'll continue our conversation with rock journalist Neil Strauss and hear more Tall Tales. And then later, a live performance from this indie folk act, of which Neil is a big fan. It's Phosphorescent, coming up later on Soundcheck.
I've been too sick to pray, Lord. That's why we ain't talked in a while. Been some of them days, Lord. I was on my
This is an encore edition of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with journalist Neil Strauss. He's looking back at his two-decade career as a music writer for Rolling Stone, The New York Times, and other publications. His latest book is called Everyone Loves You When You're Dead, Journeys into Fame and Madness. One of the interviews excerpted in the book is with this former Oasis singer, Noel Gallagher. Here he is singing Rock and Roll Star. He feels his position as a rock and roll star, doesn't he?
I think even more than that. I remember, like, I asked him, if you were playing in the 60s, in the time of the Beatles, where do you think you'd be? And he goes, easy. In the 60s, it would have been the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Oasis, and then the Who. Like, I loved it.
And then the Who.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the hubris. I mean, even the difference between, like, kind of British pop stars and American pop stars is the American ones just think it. They don't say it out loud.
Most of the British don't seem to say that kind of thing. That's Noel. That's not Brits.
Yeah.
That's Noel Gallagher.
That's Noel and Liam. And some of those other bands, The Verve and people like there's a certain – I think it's just a certain breed of arrogant, narcissistic. It takes that sometimes to be a front.
Who actually says everyone loves you when you're dead?
Yeah, nobody – I say that.
Okay.
Here's why I say that. I say that because you go and you interview these legends who are just changed the face of not just music but culture. Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, just countless people in the book, and they're miserable. You know, they're miserable because they're haunted by a scandal that happened maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago. That not only do people not care about anymore, but that they just make them more interesting these decades later. They're haunted by negative reviews that just. You know, they're haunted by, there's Bo Diddley still mad that Elvis is getting the credit for rock and roll. But you know what, Bo Diddley, you're one of the three guys who's also seen as inventing rock and roll with Chuck Berry and Little Richard. And, you know, these things that they don't matter, you know. Mm-hmm. You just, and I just learned this lesson from all these interviews that you have to be happy with who you are. You have to be happy with what you've done. And fighting these battles and being upset of these little things that won't matter when you're gone is just such a waste of the life you have. And it just broke my heart to see these people I looked up to so much who just changed culture just just still being miserable and feeling like nobody cared about them, and it was only when they died that all of a sudden you see, you read their obituary, and that's not the person who they thought they were.
And what about for you? I mean, what kind of response have you gotten to this book, to the things that you've chosen to reveal here?
You know, it just came out today, so I'm curious to see the inbox. You can tell a lot, by the way, about a musician by how they respond to the article you write. And you never know what they're going to be upset by, because something's going to trigger their own insecurity. They may think you're trying to portray them as an alcoholic just because you mentioned they have a beer, even though that wasn't even your intention. And their reaction to an article says more about themselves than sometimes the article itself.
Well, the back of the book has, you know, satisfied customers like Bo Diddley and Lady Gaga and Chuck Berry. And then there's Phil Collins. What's going on with Phil Collins?
I was a music critic at the New York Times for 10 years, and I reviewed a Phil Collins concert. It wasn't a good show, and I actually tried to go gentle. And lo and behold, 3 days later in the mail, I get this 2-page handwritten screed on stationery from the Peninsula Hotel, and it's Phil Collins. His last words are, "Well, Neil, F you."
Yeah.
I saw you pause nervously as I was about to go there. Yeah.
Well, it says on the back of the book,
exactly.
Too.
It was another version of "Everyone Loves You When You're Dead." Here's this guy who just performed, you know, Madison Square Garden for all these people. And the review, again, wasn't mean-spirited or harsh or anything like that. It just burned him up so much. He'd done a few drafts. It was like there wasn't a single cross out on there. And, you know, it was kind of heartbreaking. The way he described, he said, "It wasn't a good show, but not for your reasons you gave. You had my head on a plate when you walked in. And I realized I'm not cool enough for the New York Times to like me." And just all these insecurities boiled out, and it just, it was one of those things where it was just sad.
Well, Neil, it serves you right. Now he's retired, and you don't have Phil Collins to kick around.
Exactly,
anymore.
It's all my fault.
You mean, mean man. Neil Strauss is author of the book "Everyone Loves You When You're Dead: Journeys into Fame and Madness." But this is not the only book that you've done. You mentioned before. Walking around with following Dave Navarro for a year. There's also a couple of books that got away from music journalism,
yes,
per se. The Game,
right,
on how to become a pickup artist, and Emergency on how to be
self-sufficient and
a survivalist,
which is very appropriate now, seeing what's going on in the world.
So, you know, is this the state? Is this a reflection of the state of music journalism, that a music journalist such as yourself has branched out into other things?
Two thoughts on that. One is, I think it's a reflection of the state of that people are human beings, and I think it's hard for anyone. You get locked into a job, and maybe the better you get it, the more you get locked into it. And the goal is to always be connecting with your passions, and those change over time. We were just talking about how you've been doing the New Sounds concerts for
29
years, and it still is your passion, but yeah, there are probably other passions that you haven't gotten to explore because you are committed to the things you do. And I think the great thing about books is I can just explore new worlds and sort of be myself, because we all have those different things we're interested in. But the state of being a music journalist is different now, and I'll tell you quickly why, which is I felt like there was this golden age of music journalism in the 80s and the 90s, or which is there if an artist recorded a record and they would go and do their Rolling Stone cover story, and this was their chance to tell the world why they did this record, who they were, what they've been going through, and this was their message, and that article became embodied, that part of their lives. Nowadays, they don't need the journalist anymore.
Mm.
They got Twitter, they got their Facebook fan page, they have their mailing list, they can communicate exactly what they want in their own words directly to their audience. And so thus, that access that I had for maybe a day or a month or a year now turns into a couple hours in a room.
On the other hand, now the artist controls the message that they're putting out about their own work, which I'm not saying that's good or bad.
That's this rub right there. Good point. Exactly. So you see them as they want to be seen, maybe
exactly,
not as they are.
Hmm. So let me ask you about something else that you wrote recently, which was a piece for the Wall Street Journal about fame and God.
Right.
At the Grammy Awards, we saw, you know, one musician after another or producer or what have you parading up to that microphone to take their little statue and thanking God.
Right.
There are a couple of instances of this in the Chris Rock in the
right
book and Stephen Colbert, among others. God and fame, how does that dynamic play
out? Well,
it
was a fascinating thing, which is when I was all done with these hundreds of interviews, I looked through them for common themes and tried to draw lessons in the book about behavior and about our own lives. And one commonality I saw was that musicians who believed that it was God's plan for them to become famous actually had a greater chance of not only becoming kind of super famous but staying there, versus musicians who had doubts, didn't think they belonged there, weren't sure if this is where they were supposed to be, didn't last there long. Example, Jack White of the White Stripes, I was with him when he first walked down the red carpet for the first time, and he's like, I'm on Mars, I don't belong here. And of course, they just broke up the White Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other people never had another top 10 single afterward. And if this isn't, you know, necessarily piety, it's sometimes narcissism, but I think it's that confidence that allows you to stay there and hold up, take the opportunities without being worried about what people are going to turn on you and what they're going to think, because it's hard to be up there. I was just walking to the studio and one of the Jonas Brothers is walking down the street and just photographers everywhere, and you know, how do you deal with that?
Right.
So having that faith helps.
So it is a kind of an unnatural life,
yeah,
when you attain that celebrity that's held up as somebody in the book, and now I'm forgetting who it is, but it's a great quote. Maybe it's Lionel Richie?
Yes, I love that quote.
All right, so then you tell it.
So he goes, you know, I say, hey, you should write a book about all your experiences. And he goes, you know, I tried so hard and worked so hard to get to the top of that mountain, and I blood, sweat, and tears, and I got to the top of the mountain. Do you know what was there? I'm like, no, what was there? And he goes, you know what was there? He goes, nothing was there. Absolutely nothing, just all the experiences you had on your way getting there.
Which is, in itself, a remarkable statement. You know,
I thought you were going to have Dancing on the Ceiling queued up right away.
Yeah.
I would have been impressed. it's true. These interviews were like therapy for me. Like, I got to learn about life through my interactions with these people.
Neil Strauss is the author of the book Everyone Loves You When You're Dead. It reflects years and years of these little journeys into fame and madness, as the book's subtitle promises us. Neil, it's a fascinating read, a series of amazing snapshots of these people. Thanks for sharing them with us today.
You know, I got to say, I never thought I'd see the moment when John Schaefer is playing Snoop Dogg and Oasis on the radio, from having listened to your show when I first moved to New York.
Right back at you, Neil. We worked for the same experimental music magazine back in the day, and now here you are with Lady Gaga and Courtney Love and all the rest. Neil Strauss, my guest on Soundcheck. If you're a big fan of Soundcheck, why not join us in the audience at our next live broadcast from the Green Space? On Wednesday, July 20th, we'll welcome Chris Thiele, the mandolin wizard behind the bluegrass group Nickel Creek and his more unconventional project called Punch Brothers. And we'll welcome New York bluegrass guitarist and vocalist Michael Daves. The two of them will perform together. They'll play songs from their new album, Sleep With One Eye Open. Here's the title track. Chris Thiele and Michael Daves live on Soundcheck in the Green Space Wednesday, July 20th at 2 p.m. For tickets, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. Coming up next, a live performance in our studio from the indie folk musician known as Phosphorescent. There's a honky-tonk down the road, just about a mile or so.